Live from the Gulf Coast, Central, and West Texas, you are listening to Free Drinks Next Week, the number one podcast at this address.
Welcome to Free Drinks Next Week, the number one wine podcast at this address. FDNW brings you your weekly conversations and something different over a bottle of something different. Join us each week to discover a new wine, beer, liquor, stories that make us tick. One part alcohol, two part story shaken, stirred, and some entertainment mixed in with it. You can find Free Drinks Next Week on iTunes, Stitcher, and Facebook, and our website to be named later. Give us a thumbs up on Stitcher Radio, like us on Facebook, and leave us a review on our iTunes page. I'd personally like to welcome our co-hosts, Mike, Christy, Cassie, and little Chris, who might join us, as you noticed with the last episode, joined us a record three times.
He did not want to go to sleep.
But that being said, what have you drank this week, and what are you drinking right now? Christy?
Look, I didn't drink anything super interesting to share with the show this week, because I work at a winery. I have a glass of wine at the end of the day. But today, I just opened up, even though I haven't tasted it, a Garrison Brothers. It's called Estacado. It's Texas straight bourbon whiskey, born and bred in High Texas. And this particular bottle was given to me by a wine club member who helps when we're busy, the couple. They're called Weekend Warriors. They volunteer for us on busy weekends, and we pay them in wine. Anyway, we all had this conversation about the Garrison Brothers in High Texas collaborated with Llano Estacado Winery in Lubbock, Texas, and they exchanged barrels. Garrison Brothers sent Llano Estacado Winery some bourbon barrels. Llano Estacado Winery sent Garrison Brothers some port barrels. So even though I haven't tasted it yet, I have just poured it in the glass. I am now going to try the Garrison Brothers Estacado, which is a bourbon that was aged in port barrels. You guys have probably all tried it, but I haven't. I'm very excited.
I could say I have not tried it, and now I just want more information. Are you drinking it neat, on ice, or blended?
I'm currently just poured it neat. I haven't sipped it. I talked to the winemaker at Llano, Llano Estacado Winery, and he said it's very strong, and he recommends it with a splash of water. So I'm going to try it neat. I'll get back to you. And then I might add some water. He said it, adding water opens it up a little bit.
Okay. And so it sounds like it's definitely a high proof that is probably closer to 100.
It's 53.5 or 107 proof.
Yeah.
It's 107 proof.
Okay. Yeah. I figured it had to be pretty hot for it to be a start at adding water. So it sounds like there might be something good on a ice ball or something there that melts slow.
Yeah, I'm just going to have two fingers and have a merry good night.
All right. And so, well, Mike, what are you drinking or what have you drank this week of interest?
Well, since I got back to Lubbock yesterday and it was really late and everything was closed, luckily had some Michelob Ultra and, of course, always have to have a bottle of Gruet Brut on hand. So that's always good for New Year's Eve. However, since I was down in Houston, I was actually at Baker Street Pub over there in La Sentara, the outdoor shopping mall, and happened to see on tap that there was a beer called No Label Brewing, and it was made right there in Katy. So thought I'd try out their El Jefe, Hefeweizen. Pretty good as far as Hefeweizens are concerned. So definitely some citrus, some tropical notes to it. Of course, Hefeweizens typically have a little bit of sourness, which I, of course, like. So pretty good beer. So I have not been to the brewery itself. However, that is going to be on my list. So No Label Brewing out there in Katy, Texas.
And it was born in the USA, El Jefe. Anyone? Anyone?
No, I missed it. What was that reference to?
El Jefe would translate from Spanish to mean the boss, even though it was spelled that way, and the boss would be Bruce Springsteen, and Bruce Springsteen sang Born in the USA.
Okay,
sorry.
I would have had that if you left it with me for like a month.
Well, okay, I got the El Jefe part, but then I thought you were going to go with, you don't have to call into work because you're the boss.
Oh.
No.
Now look at you with your pizza. I know. Yeah. You're on the wrong week.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't have got it at all. So thank you for the explanation. And Cassie, what are you drinking?
I am drinking, what is it? Hazania Vinas Viejas from Rioja. Right?
Yeah, it looks like it's a Spanish cab blend.
It's really good, y'all.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
It's really good.
If y'all have a...
That's from Rioja, and there's no Tempranillo?
It's probably some Tempranillo in there. There's absolutely... Oh, my fault. It's 85% Tempranillo.
Yeah.
Okay, just checking. Sorry. I was like, a cab blend.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, being from where it's from. It's 85% Tempranillo, 15% Graciano.
Nice.
And it's phenomenal. I bought two bottles because I was going to let one age a little longer, but now I might have to go back and get a couple extra bottles.
Yeah, it's really good. I strongly recommend it.
And so it's about 13% alcohol. I think the bottle costs less than $19. Rated a 92 in the Wine Enthusiast. So if you like their rating or the wines that they rate, this will fall right into your palate.
Yeah, and it's a 2014. So.
Yeah, it could only get better.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I'm drinking the same thing this evening. And last night we did follow up on a story from our last episode, 110, and going to the Thistle, the craft brewery bar located in Spring, Texas, off of 2920. It's so spacious. And it's the opposite of almost a sports bar. There is a projector, but they weren't showing sports. Maybe this is a one-time thing. They were showing the ball drop in New Orleans as well as in New York.
Correct.
But in addition to that, it has about, I would think, 40 to 60 taps. It's an oval bar, so you sit around it, and there's really no bad seat inside.
Is it marble?
No, it's probably granite or some fake other material.
That would still look nice.
Yeah, it looked nice. It definitely did. I would recommend this, so next time y'all are in town, we have to try the Thistle. I tried something called the TPX, their beer there. I also drank a St. Arnold's, or I drank a Left Hand Nitro. That was pretty good, and that's a milk stout. And then I had one other beer. But it was pretty good. I do recommend it if you're in the Houston area. Try the Thistle. I think it just opened last week. And I finally think we found the bar in the area that's just not a wine bar. And also doesn't smell like a cigarette.
Yeah.
I have no time starting a new favorite bar like Schooners or Bashes. Yeah. I have no interest in going to dive bars anymore.
And I had, I just had wine. It was called Molly Docker.
It was
Merlot. And that was pretty good for what it was. I mean, I didn't...
Molly Duker.
No, but Molly Docker.
Molly Docker, not Molly Duker. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has like a lady riding
like
on
a... Yeah.
I don't know. It had a lady. We couldn't tell whether it was an older lady or a younger lady, but she was on a scooter, and it looked like she was going down a hill really, really fast. From just, you know, from the bottle when they poured it, I just saw it on the bar. So I should have asked to look at it, but I guess I was just enjoying my night. And it was, like Chris said, it was really spacious, and it had, like going towards the bathroom, it had like a little, not that it was enclosed or anything, but it had a little room, and it had like leather seating and stuff in there, and so it's like if you had a more smaller intimate party, you could probably just sit over there and have some drinks and stuff like that. And then I didn't really see on the opposite end of the bar, but I want to say there was probably an enclosed, like, private party area, but again, I wasn't quite sure. So, but it was still pretty, spacious and fairly new. I think there was probably maybe in all 15 people in there, including us, maybe.
Yeah, wow. 15 to 20, so it wasn't many. I'm not sure if there's a lot of people that know about it yet.
Yeah.
It's been under construction a while, but yeah, definitely gets the thumbs up, and we'll try again when y'all come to town.
Yes.
Cool.
Awesome.
All right. And so, well, the first article is actually a video, but I'll go ahead and read it, but on the show, the recording, it'll be in video format. And this one has a little bit of political connotations with it, if the article ever opens. But it's posted by KXAN. NAFTA negotiations could affect avocado and beer prices. Negotiations around North American Free Trade Agreement are uncertain footing after the first series of meetings in December, as changes to NAFTA could fundamentally alter the way the U.S., Canada, and Mexico trade goods. One state that has the potential of being greatly affected is Texas, Mexico's nearest neighbor. Congressman Will Hurd said changes in NAFTA could cause the prices of imports to skyrocket, which would unfortunately include beer. Hurd said that 17% of the beer consumed in the U.S. comes through his district. Mexico is Texas's number one trading partner, Hurd said. And you know, if we get this wrong, we could see an increase in the beer price when we go out. I don't think anyone wants that. What are your thoughts of it, of the potential import or impact of NAFTA, especially as a Corona drinker like yourself, Mike?
Well, you know, it's, I guess it's something that's been said in the past, but free trade, you know, spreads democracy. So looking at it from a political perspective, when you open up borders, when you trade with people, A, you eliminate tariffs on products, so, you know, pricing stays relatively depressed. You also are encouraging them to play by the same rules of your market and everything. So definitely, you know, nobody wants to pay more for Corona. I mean, it's already one of the most expensive, or among the most expensive of your kind of common beers and everything. So definitely bad.
And
not only Corona, but Tecate, Modelo. But I'm less concerned about beer because I don't drink very much beer. I'm more concerned about guacamole.
And when we reviewed this article a little earlier, I think Cassie and I reviewed it briefly, particularly the prices of avocados and how that could have an effect on this, that already the price of avocados has seen an increase of about 80% over the last year. So that indicates that likely if NAFTA isn't revised or remain in force, that we'll see another increase on the avocado price. Is there a price ceiling where avocados are too expensive to enjoy? And if so, how bad will that hurt Tex-Mex restaurants that proliferate across Texas?
I don't know, because I feel like sometimes, like, I have some friends, let's just take Chipotle. I think it's like $1.50 to get guacamole with your Chipotle, $1.50 extra. I don't mind paying that, but I have friends who are like, I'm not paying $1.50 for guacamole. but at some point, I'd be like, no, but I love it. And it's a staple of my diet.
Can
I without it? Sure. But do I want to? No.
Has that always been additional cost at Chipotle, or was that a recent revising of their menu pricing?
I have not eaten at Chipotle my whole life, but as long as I have been, which has been almost 5 years of living here, yes.
Yeah, it's a,
it's been not price. It hasn't gone up, but I'm like, it's fine. But you know how markups are in restaurants. That's not even a, it's like high-end fast food. It's not a restaurant, like a sit-down restaurant, but you could sit down. But it's also not like Taco Bell.
It's just high enough to where you're not going to have to pay a tip, but not cheap enough where
right.
where you could choose something off of a $5 or a dollar menu.
Right.
And then you could possibly also get poisoning, but I think they said Chipotle got over that.
Oh, guys, you have no idea what I did last year, did you? Because
no.
there were a couple of places that had the whatever it was with the poisoning, but I never had trouble at my Georgetown one. And last summer they did a promo, like buy X amount. It was like a card, like if you get this amount. And it was a 3-month goal. So every month you could win something. You could win a free burrito, you could win this. But I saw the ultimate prize. I kept my eyes on the prize and I did the big one for 3 months. And I cheated a little bit in that sometimes I would have a friend that's like, I want some Chipotle. You want to give me your card? Sure. I'll give you my card. And then I'll invite you to my Super Bowl party. So basically, I want a free catering for $250, and I used it for the Super Bowl last year.
Well played. Okay, Chipotle for the win. I actually never had Chipotle.
I never got sick. It's
and
like
I don't
free
think
birds,
most people get sick.
Better.
Oh, it's nothing like Freebirds. Yeah. One is owned by the Aggies and took over the Pinocchio spot in Lubbock, and the other is Chipotle.
I'm just saying, I really actually love Chipotle. I know why I love it is because I feel like I can eat relatively healthy quickly and not crazy pricing. But yes, $1.50 guacamole. So what is that going to translate to at a restaurant? Some restaurants it's like $6, $7, $8, $9 for guacamole. I'm not going to pay for it if it's $20. I'm not going to do it.
And now that I think about it, there's a lot of Tex-Mex Mexican restaurants where they used to give guacamole as part of the initial sauce, chips, and guacamole. But now guacamole is an additional thing you have to purchase. And or it comes on the side with your tacos. They just no longer freely give it away like they used to 10 or 15 years ago. So the cost is definitely seen. It's just how much is that going to increase and what's the barrier for consumers to continue to purchase it? And so, well, in stories, this is in Central Texas, our Austin area. Beer bar Flying Saucer in Austin is closing. The last day is today. Flying Saucer Drought Emporium, located in the Triangle, is closing in Austin location. Its last day will be Monday, January 1st. However, co-owner Shannon Wynn is looking for a new Austin location for the Flying Saucer. The landscape of the restaurant industry is changing rapidly across the nation, the co-owner said, and unfortunately, the beer industry was introduced to a topsy-turvy legislation which has harmed our Austin saucer significantly, as well as 100 retailers across the state. Financially, it did not make sense to operate in the location anymore. Eater reached out to Wynn, and he clarified that he was referring to the fact that breweries can now sell its own beer. Beer Nerds, the name for Flying Saucer's UFO club members who are running to receive plates commemorating their 200 beer at the bar, will be able to pick those up on Saturday, January 6th, as well as have one last beer. Flying noted that its employees will be able to transfer to another Flying Saucer location if they should choose to. This location was opened in the Austin Bar 10 years ago. The original location debuted in Fort Worth in 1995 and grew with 16 bars across the country, 6 other locations in Texas. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the Flying Saucer, they're called that because after you have 200 beers, they put 200 on a saucer and put it on the wall or the ceiling, and you're commemorated for being a consistent drinking partner of the Flying Saucer. what I find interesting in this article is the point where they are disappointed in the change in distributor laws.
I think breweries should be able to have their own tasting room, but I think it's ridiculous to not have. Flying Saucer is a great franchise or organization, and I think they will do really well in some markets. It makes complete sense to me that they don't do well in Central Texas. I don't know about South Texas, where you're at, but I know in West Texas, nobody cares so much about craft beer. Some people like craft beers, but, like, craft beers are the thing here. It's very much a part of the culture here. When I first moved here, I would go to a place and ask for a Corona or a Coors Light on a hot summer day, just wanting something refreshing, and I would get the snobbery from the bartenders. It wouldn't matter where I was at. And I just quit drinking beer. That worked out for me anyway. I'm like, I don't know what all these local beers are, and I just want something that I know and that's nice and refreshing. But people are really about the craft beers here, and I appreciate it. I understand because I work at a winery. So if you're producing something, why should you not be able to sell it directly to the consumer? Or let the consumer taste it directly. And a lot of people are making their own beers, too. So it just might not be the right market for them. They did really well in Dallas and Fort Worth.
They also do really well in Houston. They have two locations here, one downtown and one in the Sugar Land area.
First, a follow-up to the last story. I don't know if you guys saw the what happened on the 30th, but 40,000 pounds of avocados were ruined on I-35 when a mechanical failure caused a truck transporting them to catch fire out on I-35 outside of Waxahachie. So just thought that was interesting. Talk about the scarcity of the market. I'm not sure how much 40,000 pounds of avocados, how long that lasts, but, you know, definitely wouldn't last forever, correct? Anyways, in terms of... I guess this is kind of a question of what the buy local versus, the idea of a chain versus the idea of, you know, something that's a little bit more local, a little bit more, shop local, buy local, represent your local economy and stuff like that. Up here in Lubbock, for instance, there's pretty much one brewery, Triple J's, which also operates as a restaurant. And everything, but I don't think there's that kind of like what Christy was talking about. I don't think there's that movement like, oh, you're drinking Budweiser, why aren't you supporting Triple J's or something like that. I definitely can see that Austin being such a local, kind of like a small town in a big city, skin and stuff like that. Like everybody wants to support the local guys more than the big national chains, and I feel like that's the same thing that could be said about. These big bars and these bar chains and stuff. Correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't Flying Saucer, were they related at all to the company that owned all of the Fox and Hounds?
I didn't think so, that there was a connection there, but with all these investments and all these, companies that are investing in the restaurant industry right now, it could be. I'll look it up while you continue.
Yeah, it just seems to me that, you know, there's an issue with that in Dallas, but I could see that it would make sense in other cities, much like what Christy said, so I agree with her.
It depends on your, like, oh, it's weird here. I mean, and that's it. Keep Austin weird. It's different, and people, and outside of, there are a lot of us with the big sense of keeping things local, but there's also a lot of, what do we call them? Hipsters. It's a big hipster community. And hipsters don't want Budweiser and Coors Light and all the beers you have from all over, wherever. They want the beers that you have here in Austin and Dripping Springs and San Marcos and all the surrounding communities. That's what they're looking for. They want to support the local economy, and I am 100% about that for the big obvious reasons.
I agree with both of you, as I just think it's weird to ostracize or vilify the local producers for wanting to be able to have the ability to sell directly to their consumers. That seems like an odd battle to pick when your whole business plan is let me have as many options available for my customers,
right,
because they're so unique and I want to make sure my customers have everything here. But I don't believe the people who produce it have the right. That just seems really weird, and I wonder how that will affect it going forward, if there will be a time where certain producers are like, no, we don't work with Saucer, or is the three-tier system protect them from that criticism truly?
Definitely a bad, it's not a good argument for the community here.
Is there a location in Austin where you think another location will work? Would it work closer to campus, or would it have to be further away?
I'm not going to lie. Again, I don't really drink beer, and I don't spend very much time in Austin. I know a lot of people, because of where I work, that are from Austin. And, of course, I get the general idea and how the community works, but I don't know that one location is going to be better than the other. Because Flying Saucer is probably going to be too expensive for college students. And then there's all the hipsters. they want the craft beers. And you get some craft beers at Flying Saucer if you're going to have 200 beers on tap. But if you're going to attack the people that are making it for selling direct and changing law legislation, I don't know that this is the home you want to be at.
Well,
probably not going to work for you.
How about some nice dumper on your 85?
How about some gold? What about?
Starting probably early to mid-2018, you're going to see many of the products that are in the grocery store and convenience stores today will begin to disappear.
Oklahoma, Colorado, and Kansas are ending the sale of 3-2 beer in their states. Now major breweries are putting Utah on notice. Fox 13 obtained this letter from Anheuser-Busch telling wholesalers that with more than 60% of 3-2 beer being eliminated by those states, Utah will end up the nation's largest consumer. And that's only 0.5%. Anheuser-Busch warns they could go from 20 brands to 12 on store shelves.
Miller Coors is telling me basically the same thing that Anheuser-Busch has been stating, that they're looking at it, and there will be some reductions in the number of products that they produce.
The legislature is contemplating moving Higher Point beers out of state-run liquor stores into grocery and convenience stores. It requires a law change. The DABC says it can't handle the increase in customers, but the chairman of Utah's Liquor Control Commission thinks local brewers could benefit.
I think it's a boon to the craft beer industry in Utah to fill that void, and they can do it very well. But that's entirely up to the legislature as to whether or not they want to give more leeway for a heavy beer to be sold in grocery stores and convenience stores. I just don't know what they're going to do.
The head of the Utah Beer Wholesalers Association says even in a state that doesn't have that many drinkers, local breweries can't handle it.
When you're talking 32 million gallons of beer sold in Utah, the craft brewers just don't have the capacity or physical facilities to produce that kind of volume.
So what are state lawmakers going to do? Maybe not much after last year's alcohol bill that tore down Zion curtains.
We ran a big alcohol bill last year. I do know there's some tweaking that's going to take place in that bill. But I don't think whether the decision's been made yet whether we're going to open a file and see if we can push the heavier beers.
They've got to make a decision soon. Anheuser-Busch says Oklahoma phases out 3-2 beer in October 2018.
That's very possible. Yeah, that we may not be handled this year. And yet, I'm not sure that it makes a lot of sense to push this until we have let's call it a violent market reaction to not having products on the shelf.
I definitely, Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't care. Like, honestly, I think the states themselves get themselves into this issue, and that, you know, you kind of think about it from a larger perspective. Most people that probably move to Utah and live in Utah are not necessarily moving there or choosing that state based upon its available beer selection, you know? Like, and that's probably not really a thought in most people's heads, like, oh, Austin, Texas, or Texas has all these craft breweries and stuff, so I'm going to move to that state. And, like, you know, I would never not move to Oklahoma because they only have, like, 3.2% ABV or something like that, you know? But it just seems to me that the states themselves, you know, anything that you kind of do to set your state behind other states in terms of available amenities and things like that, just seems kind of dumb to me. And, like, I get that it's a religious thing, and I totally understand from the perspective of the people inside that religion and stuff that, you know, of course you don't want your kids tempted, or you don't want anything that's too alcoholic or anything, but I mean, 12 versus 20, I couldn't name 20, and I probably couldn't even name 12 right now, so I guess that's still enough in my mind.
I have a completely different school of thought. My school of thought is, pull it all out. You're making enough money. How much money is Utah and Oklahoma and Kansas? Really, Kansas?
Yes, Kansas.
How much money are you really making in these states? I mean, like, think about Anheuser-Busch. Seriously? They could lose the three states. Quit making it. Quit distributing it. Quit selling it. Everybody shut them off. And then get their people to change the legislation. Because the people that are there that want to drink, and if they don't, then it's fine. And I know somebody right now that has a job in Utah, and his wife is still in Georgetown, but it was too good of a deal to pass up. And they enjoy wines and craft beers and all of these things. So he actually took a bunch of our wine with him, so he has stuff that he can drink. But
is Utah a state where you could ship in alcohol?
No, I'm pretty sure it's one of the few that has absolutely no shipping under no circumstances.
I'm pretty sure Utah is a felony state, and so is Oklahoma. Like, you know, you can't ship in then. They're very strict on their alcohol laws.
Okay.
But I just think sometimes maybe you need to make a drastic measure to get the changes to happen.
You know, it's interesting because I've mentioned on the show, I went to this place called Boulevard Brewing in Kansas City, and their beers aren't necessarily 3.2 and everything, ABV. So I don't know if maybe that's just the national distributors are forced to cut their alcohol by volume or something like that if they go into one of these states. But, yeah, definitely very interesting. So.
Well, maybe what the big concern is here, it's kind of weird that Anheuser-Busch would have to make this announcement. And if anything, it's probably for shareholders to let them know why is there going to be a decrease in production or in sales in this one state particularly. And it's because of those laws, since shareholders only care about returns, not really the reasoning or the concerns for those returns being down. There was an article published in the Business Insider indicating that craft beer and big beer are engaged in a civil war, but they might have a bigger problem to worry about. The article written by Kate Taylor in December 16, 2017, it indicates that Budweiser parent company says it's worried about wine and spirits, not craft beer. Beer overall, the category, lost 10% of market share to wine and hard liquor from 2006 to 2016. And one craft brewer that was acquired by AB InBev said that the craft versus big beer debate is simply a distraction from the coming war with wine and spirits. In late July, Goldman Sachs downgraded both Boston Beer Company and Constellation Brand based on the data that younger consumers prefer wine and spirits to beer, as well as the fact they're drinking less alcohol than older generations more generally. Could this have an effect on why they're making that announcement, or is there a bigger concern overall? Because as you indicated in the conversation earlier, Austin isn't a city that cares about mass adjunct lagers. They care about the local beer companies. And even that, they say the numbers aren't what craft breweries and what we've always heard for craft brewing, the market share that they should need or do have.
That's interesting.
And so is this something that you've ever discussed, you two discussed when you were in the wine industry at, like, industry events or meetings?
No.
I'll let Christy go first.
Well, I haven't. I think so. A civil war. If in these particular states, you're having near beer and you're having lower alcohol by volume beer, but your wine and spirits are allowed to be at their same alcohol volume, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, I do want to correct it. I don't think that the measurement is by volume per se. It's based on year-to-date sales. So that though they are measuring volume year to date, they're just indicating it's going down from what the entire industry has been projecting over all that. The category is growing so big that there isn't the need for the larger companies. And this article is saying all of the companies have an issue because people don't want this much beer.
Do they not want this much beer, or they don't want this much near beer?
Well, I don't think this one is near beer related because this is nationwide.
Yeah, this is something that we talked about, how like the beer industry, even craft beer is up, but it's not like it's like up 1% or something like that. But like the domestic beer and the international beer market are down, and those numbers sound right to me. From my perspective, having had some of these discussions internally and everything, you know, even the wine industry, it's I want to say Texas wines in retailers is actually down, as I recall, because the market is getting flooded with a lot of new wine brand and everything. And it, just because that's the trend right now is going towards wine and liquor and away from beer, and where it's going towards beer, where millennials are consuming beer, it's like we've been discussing, it's craft beer, it's local beer, I would go away from even saying it's craft, it's local. I would say it's beer with a story. You know, I mean, you know, everybody's parents drank Budweiser and Bud Light and Michelob Ultra and everything. And I definitely think this generation, more than any other, wants to set itself apart from what previous generations have done, for instance, right? And so I kind of get the impression that, you know, that for the most part, the kind of what my generation and especially the generation that's coming right after me is going to want that special experience, you know, going to a brewery, hence why the laws have changed, as we just discussed, going to a winery. And, you know, as soon as Texas kind of modernizes its liquor laws, I expect that we'll see an explosion in Texas of more distilleries, more, you know, we still don't have a brandy and everything, as I'm pointing out and saying, if anybody wants to go into business with me. But, you know, I don't think it's like what Christy was saying, kind of bringing that point back up. I don't think it's just near beer. I think it's all beer. But I do think that it makes sense for, Anheuser-Busch to cut down on, you know, producing 12 instead of 20, because, you know, they could put their money and their resources towards maybe more small craft experiences, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and kind of piggybacking off of what you're saying is, I think you're absolutely right. In the insurance industry, we notice one of the big trends is that this generation clearly is trying to distinguish themselves from the previous generation. That for the most part, teenagers aren't as excited about getting a vehicle at 16 as they once were. Texas, for the most part, is an exception, but they are starting to see that people are willing just to drive Uber and ride with friends and car share just because of their thought process. The other one being is, I'm not sure if this has, if they've accounted for all the causality that could be related to this. And what I mean by there is, sure, it could be that people just dislike beer a little less, are appreciating wine and spirits more. But also there's a large amount of income disparity and less disposable income than it was a generation ago. And a generation ago had less disposable income than the generation prior to it. And I think that could be a big deal. People aren't going to the bars and buying those beers or utilizing happy hour. Or if they're just deciding, instead of going to the bar and spending $20 on beers, I'm just going to buy me a bottle of wine for that $14 category. Or I'm just going to get me a fifth of liquor. I think all those could have an influence on why the beer segment's down. But it's something definitely to watch for, as Budweiser has been consolidating the beer industry, buying the largest and the best brewers and manufacturers over the last 5 years.
You know, also to expand upon another one of your points, because you talked about the three-tier system, you know, it's something that distributors, you know, it's I don't know if their business plan over the past 15 years, where it's like you just mentioned, Budweiser, you know, is, Anheuser-Busch is the largest beer distributor in the world, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Their business model has been, and this is part of capitalism, where, you know, you don't have strong antitrust laws and anti-competition laws, is that, you know, they're allowed to purchase as many parts of the smaller segments as they want, correct? And that this has been kind of a consolidation effort on their part. However, I don't think that they accounted for the internet age being such a big kind of booster of this local craft movement that, you know, my generation has kind of definitely taken the flag for and is carrying the torch for, to where I think you're kind of getting a little bit of pushback against companies like Anheuser-Busch and, you know, big wine companies that are like, oh, Barefoot's, oh, you also own Barefoot. Oh, you also own this. Okay, well, then what makes their story special compared to everything else, right? And laws like these taproom laws that, you know, distributors have been fighting against pretty significantly, and laws like wine shipping laws, which distributors also hate, and the three-tier system hates, because they want that money. They, but we're seeing that this generation, like, oh, okay, wait, I went to the winery, I got their story and everything, it's going to cost me an extra 20 to 30 bucks to get it shipped to me? Oh, I don't care about that. It's not a money thing. Like you just said with the Uber, it's not a money thing, other than the fact that, you know, I'm not going to say this generation is thrifty, but they're kind of like, on some things they don't care about spending money, like, oh, 40 bucks for an Uber ride as opposed to paying for parking and potentially getting a ticket or drinking and driving. Yeah, I'll pay for that Uber and everything. And even though it might have only cost me $1, $2 in gas, right? But the same thing is going with alcohol. You know, you're seeing people want to direct ship from the winery that they went to and visited and got the story from. Same thing with breweries, where people want to be able to, you know, that's my major argument right now is, hey, I went to Boulevard in Kansas, why can't I get it shipped to me, right? But I can't because it's illegal to get beer shipped across state lines, apparently. So, but yeah, going back to your point and everything, I think that there is a huge pushback, and especially in the next 10 years, the alcohol industry is going to change fundamentally. Or, I mean, it's going to have to if it wants to survive. And if it doesn't want to start shrinking, kind of like what we're seeing with the big, big beer distribution, as you just pointed out. Liquor, I don't know, because I think that we're 20 years away from comprehensive liquor shipping laws and everything like that. But, That may be where a lot of these companies have to start making their money.
It has to be a priority for every state, and it's going to be a lot more difficult than we're just saying, oh, people need to change, or it needs to be a big push. Every single state and the people that live in that state have to make it a priority when sessions are in. And there's so many other priorities. So many priorities. Medicare, Medicaid, and all kinds of health care. There's a plethora of issues. And this issue really goes back to the repeal of prohibition, where basically the federal government said, sure, it's okay, but each state regulates its own. So it's very taxing to get things moving forward in that direction, because you're looking at all of these states trying to do it. Like, I don't know any state who can have wine ship in and out from all of the states. Like an ongoing battle, and do you want to pay this much for these bonds, and do you want to pay this much for these labels? How many people from New York are actually going to buy? Is it worth putting up this money? Is it worth paying these particular taxes? Is it worth doing all the paperwork and paying somebody to do it? It's a little more complex and complicated than just we need to make a change. And I don't think it's going to be easy or quick.
Off the top of my head, the three states right now in the nation that allow as much wine as a consumer wants to purchase to be shipped in are California, Colorado, and Florida. Those three states have no volume limits and everything. It's three kind of different states as far as looking at it. California obviously has its own robust wine industry. The largest in the nation with well over 1,500 wineries in the state. They, however, are not at all worried about competition, clearly, by the fact that they allow their residents of the state of California to order as much wine from out of the state as they want. Colorado has a smaller wine industry, much smaller than California or Texas or most other states, but it's also very affluent state. So that's kind of more, it seems to be residential directed, in that they want their residents to be able to order as much as humanly possible. Florida, I don't really know too much about the state wine industry, other than my theory that so many people retire to Florida that they want their residents to be able to order from all of their home states once again. So that's kind of my thoughts about Florida, for instance. But, you know, it's to me, I can understand Texas a little bit, other than the fact, but I've heard from people that more of Texas 15 cases per person per year, something like that, is more derived from a consumption limit than necessarily a fear of protecting the local Texas wine industry and stuff like that, i.e. that's what they think that the maximum amount that a citizen of Texas should consume of wine per year.
I'm not even talking about what the states are allowing their residents to consume by year, but the ease or lack of ease to be able to ship to and from every single state. Every single state regulating its own makes things very complicated, because every state has a different criteria to meet and different monetary guidelines and different tax issues, et cetera, et cetera. So it makes it very difficult from a functioning administrative side to do these things. But while you're pointing out those three states, I would like to add that Colorado and California are also fairly liberal in their marijuana laws, which are, as much as some people might not want to see it, basically the same thing has happened. The federal government said, it's up to the state. So we're seeing the same thing happen, but just with a different substance.
I would also kind of like to once again piggyback off of another point that you were making in terms of it being Colorado, Florida, and California. And this is just by general perception, not backed by facts or anything. But these are states where you do recognize there is a class of individuals who have secondary homes in addition to also retiring to these respective states. And I don't think it could be discounted what the influence is of affluent landowners moving into a state and saying they still want the stuff that they're able to have in their other state of residence. That the people who live in Colorado or Florida or, like, in Texas, we have winter Texans. People who come down from Canada or the entire Midwest in their RVs and they park at the coast and hang out there to it, the frost up north. Maybe we're not too far away if it wasn't for our legislature. And up until recently, we did have the ability to have stuff shipped in and companies that would allow it. How far are we away from Texas allowing alcohol to be shipped back in? Because I noticed that many sites won't allow it if you're ordering through Total Wine or if you're ordering through anything pretty much.
Wait, are you talking about wine or liquor?
Liquor.
I'm not even sure if in California if you can order liquor.
Oh, okay.
And everything through the mail. I mean, of course, I can Google it while I'm talking and stuff, but liquor is viewed as, you know, the devil's drink.
Juice.
And so, yeah, you definitely have to understand that I don't think anybody wants, currently, I don't think it's on any legislative agenda to put liquor anywhere.
Okay. And maybe that's what it is. But, all right. And I guess we'll do one last alcohol story, or story based on it. And this is a year-end review while Mike is looking up the respective shipping laws. This is the year in review of what's been, I guess, happened in the alcohol industry and what are they expecting. If anybody has go ahead.
Oh, no. Go ahead. I just hate that this is the last alcohol story because I like this other one. I had something to add that was in regards to, I didn't get to read the whole thing because I stopped immediately to look something up.
Okay, what story is it?
I feel like it was a Super Bowl and the alcohol companies weren't providing enough rides.
Okay, I know which one it is. I have it. And so what?
A new California law that takes effect January 1st is intended to prevent drunk driving, but some worry it could have the opposite effect.
When planning for the Super Bowl in Santa Clara last year, State Assemblyman Evan Lowe saw something in California law he didn't like.
During this time, it became apparent to myself that these companies were not able to provide free or discounted rides to individuals getting home safely.
He's talking about companies that make alcohol. But starting January 1st, alcohol manufacturers can partner with a rideshare or cab company ahead of an event like the Super Bowl and make arrangements for transportation for partygoers.
It's my belief that individuals and adults will continue to do the activities that they deem fit for themselves. And it's imperative that in the state of California, we provide them an opportunity to do so, but responsibly.
Groups like Alcohol Justice oppose the change. On its website, it says the bill implicitly allows for beer manufacturers to promote the overconsumption of alcohol. People we talked with disagree.
I just think it's freedom of choice, ultimately, and I don't think it's going to cause necessarily people to drink more than they would.
I think people will be going to these parties to drink, or at least I'll be a part of it, so I think providing free rides makes perfect sense.
The rides could come in the form of a voucher or discount code. In San Jose, Katie Marzullo, ABC 7 News.
I don't think people can see your spirit hands.
Do I have it on? I do. It's on. I like Uber and Lyft. I've used it.
Well, it's just not Uber and Lyft. It's the ability for the alcohol manufacturers to be able to pay for it, your ride home.
I think it's a good idea. I mean, if you're, well, I don't know.
All right. Christy?
Okay, this is why I was so interested in this story, because I was like, oh, I finally have something practical to add to this. When I was in Kentucky, now granted, I didn't get to use it, but because my travel times were weird, but I was coming back from the airport on the weekend, and when I got to the airport, I got a promo code from one of the bourbon manufacturers for a free $15 credit for an Uber, and I was like, that is so cool. Of course, I was on my way out, so I wasn't able to use it, but it really... I haven't forgotten it, although I did forget the name of the brand because I'm not really a bourbon juicer. But I thought it was super cool because here's the thing. If you're at a sporting event, you're going to drink however much you're going to drink. So why not just have a safe ride option? And if that safe ride is free, and it's a win-win. These people are buying the alcohol. The alcohol company is reimbursing this. Everybody's happy. And I think it's a really great a marketing job and brand loyalty job. I was very impressed with the company. And if I drink bourbon, then I probably would remember the name of the company, but I don't. So I don't. But I have never been offered a free ride from an alcohol company before. I feel like if I was in Louisville, Kentucky, home of the Kentucky Derby, that was a great place to be offered that. And I thought it was very cool, and I would support more businesses doing that. Keep the streets safe. We want everybody to have a good time, but let's keep it safe.
I think it's weird that the opponents to the legislation are discouraged by the law because people will drink more. And I think that they make the assumption that people were limiting their drinking at these events, especially like Super Bowl parties, based on their transportation home. I just think people meant they would either leave early or leave a little later. But it's either the government's job to limit how much people drink in general or just limit how much they drink on the road. And I think if you could get people off the road, who cares how much they actually drink?
Yeah, I mean, people should, the people serving should be responsibly serving, but like we mentioned a couple episodes ago, you can't tell if you serve this one person one drink and they just had four drinks in a short amount of time and it hasn't processed through their system, you don't know. Like, they seem normal, and then all of a sudden, they're drunk, and you just served them one drink. I think it's just nice. It's nice to offer a ride. I think it's responsible, and I think people are going to drink what they're going to drink, and people are going to make mistakes, and people are going to be human. So offer them a free ride. This is a great idea.
My point in everything is that is a little bit of a cynical one. For instance, in the state of Texas, fines collected from directly resulting from drinking and driving are totaling close to $1 billion a year in everything. Now, any opportunity or anything that cuts into that, i.e. ride sharing or anybody attempting to get people home safely, obviously starts to cut into the bottom line of the state's budget. I mean, $1 billion is not nothing. That's not easily made up through other fines and things like that. And so I can understand governments need to say, oh, well, this shouldn't be allowed because blah, blah, blah. And my point on this is that I'm extremely frustrated with so many things about government as relating to people of a more conservative nature who hate government interfering in people's lives unless it's issues of moral issues like this and stuff. Like, oh, you mean you could get more people drinking and driving off of the road? This is like a no-brainer for everybody, except for conservatives who, like, well, you're pushing alcohol and blah, blah, blah. And my point is Christie's point. People are at sporting events. People are going to drink. There's an entire industries devoted to getting people to consume more. And these industries are also trying to do it in a responsible manner and say, hey, here's $15 off your Uber ride, which $15 in most places gets you home to a hotel, your apartment, or your house, or something like that. And there's a huge frustration on my part, and I feel like a lot of people, when government is once again interfering in something that it doesn't need to be interfering in. I can't think of a law, or I can't think of why any laws would be specifically written to disable companies from getting people home safely. Like, that's just the dumbest thing in the world. Now, my other point is that, of course, there's already states looking at, with ride sharing on the increase, and especially if you look up articles relating to millennials, and like Chris was pointing out, you know, car ownership is down, and they're like, hey, it's just safer to catch a ride with a friend or to take an Uber home after the bar. Some states are already looking at different things, for instance, lowering the legal limit. Utah was the first state in the nation to lower it to 0.05 and everything earlier this year, which we've already discussed Utah at length, but I think that it's worth noting that, you know, these states are looking at taking in essentially less money with ride sharing on an increase, less people drinking, driving, and companies trying to kind of, you know, protect people on the road and say, hey, here's your next Uber ride. Here's your ride home. You know, go home safely. And so, you know, I think it's worth kind of looking at government with a slightly conspiratorial eye and saying, okay, why are they lowering it to 0.05? Oh, because they're probably going to take in less money. And so just to be on the lookout for different states, because no other state wants to be looked at as weak on alcohol, right? Or weak on drunk driving. And so definitely look for different issues and agendas being pushed at certain conservative state legislatures, like Texas, for instance, in 2 years. And be wary of these things. And even though companies are trying to take responsibility and people are trying to take responsibility, ultimately, there's a lot of money involved in fining people for drinking and driving. So that's my point. I'm sticking to it.
I did want to follow up on your point at the cost that of loss of possible income that the states could see coming in with losses. And I'm using Texas as an example. And this is coming from the Insurance Journal of 2017. The last release numbers are, I guess, the numbers in this article are referencing 2015, that there are 175,000 traffic crashes related to alcohol in that time. Out of those, 3,757 fatalities in 2016 as a result of the loss. That being said, it comes out to about $2 billion in insurance-related losses, as well as insurance premium that has to be made up as a result of that. Is there other ways to save these localities instead of DUIs? Because I would think there's much better way for an officer to spend their time instead of just waiting by the bars for someone to leave in their car, instead of waiting by the bars to make sure someone's not robbed, stabbed, or assaulted.
Is there a better way for them to be spending their time? I mean, you know, there's a lot of crime, obviously, that is non-traffic related. You know, personal robberies and things like that. You know, but we don't necessarily want them sitting at a traffic light once again waiting for somebody to, you know, speed through, although that's also a concern. And maybe, I don't know, maybe just with better police presence on the roads in general, the roads would get safer. as opposed to them kind of waiting for the surety of, you know, busting one person a night sitting outside of the bar. Although that's, I'm not sure that that's entirely legal. I think that even if someone leaves a bar, they still have to demonstrate or they have to do something that would cause them to be pulled over. Like if they drive home and stop at every stoplight, they go the speed limit, they can't get pulled over just from leaving a bar, if I recall correctly. Like they still have to demonstrate something to the officer to the effect of they are not capable or of the decision-making ability to drive, or they're impaired and stuff like that. So.
Okay. And any other thoughts on it, Cassie or Chrissy?
I think it depends on where you're at, for instance. Oh, look, I'm Mike Laughlin. I said, for instance. We're all from, well, not all from, but we all lived in Lubbock area, which is a big college town. It's legitimately a college town, so there's not as high of, I'm not saying there aren't other crimes or other things going on, but not as many violent crimes. And a lot of population per area that's young drinkers. So I get in some instances you're going to want to be out there, even if your presence just being there is making a person think, am I okay to drive? Maybe I should call an Uber. Maybe I should get a ride from your friend. I understand it in some instances.
Okay.
You're just trying to keep people safe.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the goal of Evolve, is to keep people safe. And the main goal of the story is an activity by an alcohol manufacturer or a company to keep people safe. And even with these parties, they could eat the $15, as that's normally your entry fee to do a tour. Or if it's a Super Bowl event, they're just giving away tickets. What's an extra $15 a person to make sure they get home safe and you're not getting sued?
You know what I think also? And I don't know where this lays. This would be an interesting thing to find out. But if you're giving away all these promos of $15 or whatever it is for the Uber ride, surely that's some kind of tax write-off. Surely.
I agree.
Marketing? Like, I don't know where it lies because the ride sharing is relatively new. It's not like it's brand new, but like for our lives, it's relatively new. So I'm not sure where that lies, but surely there's some kind of tax write-off for that. And if there isn't, there should be. We should be voting for that legislation.
I agree. I guess to me, I always think of if they do go ahead and it's full blown, like all the companies decide to do this. Like I just think from when Christopher gets older and he goes to college and all that, and he's like, "Hey, I got a free boat. Okay, we'll be safe."
Like I said, I'm hoping when he gets older, he won't be driving.
I know, because we're gonna have
he'll
a
just live
Uber
off of
account.
Uber. I've already calculated how much it costs to get a kid in a vehicle for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Uber's still
That's
the
funny.
Better option.
It is.
And he gets still the freedom there to where he can go home if he's drunk. Now, if we have a daughter, I'm not sure I would think the same way. Just as like a woman traveling at night with like a random person picking him up in the car, I feel like it's a completely different situation. And maybe that makes me sexist.
And
but that's
maybe
just the way I feel.
She should be in karate or, I don't know, self-defense.
She should just carry a gun at all times. How that works inside of the bar, the getting in the car, I do not know. But just putting it out there.
Maybe just hire a bodyguard.
Well, now we're speaking on lives that I haven't lived yet. I do not have money for a bodyguard.
Yeah.
yet. So I would definitely have to get some investment from somewhere else to be able to pull that off, for sure. And so, anything to add on this story?
No, but thanks for letting me tell that, because I had never experienced that before, and I thought it was very cool.
No, that definitely is a good story. And now I'm going to look for that next time I go to Kentucky, is just walk around the airport till I get those free passes for $15.
Okay, so I don't think it was about the airport, because the guy I'm dating was there. He got the same one the same day. I had to leave early because I was supposed to be meeting my dad back here. But it was a weekend. It was a Friday. So I think it's just that it was Friday. It was like maybe everybody in the area, but I don't know how the demographics work. But when you accepted it, or if you used it, you did have to agree that you were 21 years of age or older. It wasn't for 18 or 19. Like, it was for people that... It was by an alcohol company, and you had to be 21 in order to be able to use it. So, which is perfectly acceptable.
Okay. Well, for the last alcohol-related story, this one comes from Vivino.com. They took all the users' information for 2017 to identify trends for 2018. They identified 7 of them, and we'll post this in the call notes. But they identified 7 points from all the users. The first one is the appreciation for dessert wine is on the rise. And so dessert wines are taking off for them. And so that's going to be an opportunity in a section that could probably use some growth in most wine stores and liquor stores. The zero sugar movement continues to gain interest. Driven by Savastyle, as well as zero sugar brands like Bellissima Zero Sugar Sparkling Wine. So we'll see that, and I have more questions on the sparkling. I guess that means it's CO2 infused and not traditional Champagne Noir style with the sugar put in there and the cap put back on. Prosecco paves the way for Cremant and Sava. That's awesome, because Cremant is amazing. Famous French wines shine, but hardly dominate. That is not picking up much around the world, but it is staying consistent. Consumption of Uruguayan tannic wines will increase. They scored an average of 4.2 across the board this year when the awards were taken. So that's a variety that we'll hear more of over the next 2 years. We will consume new and interesting Portuguese wines, so more than just port, and that should be a good wine being so close to Spain. Consumption of Australian wines will continue to grow, especially Pinot Noirs, which is showing significant increase worldwide, as well as Chardonnay for the region. California Chardonnay favors oak and butter. That will continue. It looks like we were going to steel for a while, and now it's going back to that buttery taste. Pinot Todd stigma will continue to dissipate, so yay for South African wines. When we started the show, that was a big topic, multiple episodes about South Africa having to throw away their wines. Small production wines climb the ranks. They saw an increase of 10% in consumer consumption year over year. The best red wine in the world is from Argentina, the Vinos Cobos project of Malbec. It's a project owned by Paul Hobbs, and that won the wine of the year with 17 in the top list. And then Spanish sherry shines for the first year. Are there any on there that you knew, surprise you, or any that you felt were left out?
Was that guy's name Paul Hobbs?
Excuse me? Chrissy?
Can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you now.
That was weird. Was that guy's name Paul Hobbs?
Hobbs. H-O-B-B-S. Oh. Yeah, not Hobbs, okay. As in beer. No, not beer.
Okay. I was distracting. I know a Paul Hawk. And I was like, if that's the name, I need to share it.
It's like we need to have a talk that you've been holding out on your wine from us for so long. Hook me up with some of that Argentinian wine.
Yeah. Hey, I'm surprised that California's going back to the oak style, but it's good because they probably need a little diversity because everybody else is doing an oak, so they probably need to stand out a bit. And I actually like the oak Chardonnay when they don't taste like a tree. I like them when they taste, when they have the good secondary fermentation, the malolactic fermentation, and they get some of the creaminess and butteriness. It tastes like buttered toast or buttered popcorn. I'm all about it. Those are my faves.
Mike?
That's my input.
Oh, what?
Oh, any thoughts on the list or things that you felt were left out or should have been added?
No. No thoughts other than, you know, I know everybody's going to cry because Texas isn't on there. But that's okay.
And Cassie?
I guess you're the first item on the list, which were dessert wines. Like, I don't know why, because I was like, that's probably more millennials than anything, because they like sweets or something. Or there's probably some weird study about it. So, I automatically thought millennials when I thought of the sweet wine portion of it. And yeah, I can see an increase of it because, you know, people that are starting off drinking wines like the sweetness of it, and then they kind of go along or whatever. And so it's like, oh, okay, yeah, let's go ahead and have this wine with dessert. Sounds good to me. Hey.
See, I actually thought the exact opposite, and now I kind of want to drill down in it. That I was thinking the sweeter wines were led by, I guess, the older millennials or Generation X. Because generally those come in such small quantities that it's not a traditional 750 milliliter. It's traditionally like 375 or smaller, and they cost a lot more money going into it as well. So unless it's like a well-off or early millennial, I don't see young millennials getting into super sweet dessert wines that the article is referencing, though the Rieslings, Prosecco, and Moscato will still be popular in that category as an entry wine. What are y'all perspectives, and where do you see the sweet wine from the winery perspective, Christy?
Our sweet wines are less sweet than most Texas sweet wines. We don't add sugar. So we actually have a lot of people that try our sweetest wine, and they're like, oh, this is so bitter. And then we send them to another winery. Well, we do, because they're not going to be happy here. We don't have what you're looking for. What I see typically, honestly, though, it's not the younger millennials. They've tasted a lot bigger variety already. They've already explored more. You know, they're not going to be able to afford to buy a house, so they're brunching and avocado toast and buying dry red wine. And they're wine snobs. I see more millennial wine snobs than their parents. I'm not kidding. But I'm in a different kind of environment. I have this particular winery that I work for, and we don't have a list of 40 or 50 wines. We have a concise list. So the people that I'm seeing are probably a little more geared towards that anyway. Yeah. But I've worked at other wineries where I've seen the complete opposite. But I've also spoke to a class at Texas Tech for marketing, and I was very surprised at how many of them actually had already drank wine and had developed a palate. And that's at a bigger school. That's a
it's a big school in Texas, so I was very shocked because I did not drink wine that young.
I didn't consider
much less know what I liked about it. You know, like, oh, I like this particular kind.
Yeah, I definitely didn't realize that much about it at the time, especially in undergrad. I was nowhere near the wine bars, even though they were so close to the library.
I agree. I didn't know nothing.
Well, in the entertainment segment, I did want to follow up. What has everybody been watching since the last show? And we'll start with you, Mike.
Rewatched Dunkirk, rewatched It and everything, because they just came out on digital download. So It, of course, I don't know. I've been telling everybody, I've been talking about this movie. I think that this movie is much better than the 1990s TV movie that came out for the book It by Stephen King. The book, of course, is way more terrifying still. But I tell everybody, this movie was way better than the 1990s version, but not as scary. And I think it's because I'd seen it already, I'd read the book, so I kind of knew all of the points that were coming out, and everything. Dunkirk, definitely a must-watch for any war movie buffs. Pretty accurate representation about the, it's called the battle, but really the evacuation of 300,000 to 400,000 British, Belgian, and French troops after... first phase of the British Expeditionary Force, and of course the French army and the Belgian armies were defeated by Hitler's armies in these kind of opening rounds of World War II. Very quiet movie, not as much dialogue, not even really as much action or anything, but very tense. And so, good movie to watch, of course. Currently on Netflix and all of that. I've got Black Mirror queued up to watch season 4 of that. Black Mirror, if you don't know it, it is a British anthology series that is now home on Netflix. Kind of taking a look at different kind of possible technological futures, and everything. Of course, having talked to Chris about this, I know his favorite episode still remains the first episode with the British Prime Minister and the pig. But it's definitely, my favorite episode is still the one that stars Toby Cabell, where people have the ability to access every single memory and everything that they've ever been a part of and witnessed, so that you have this couple fighting, for instance, and like, and she's like, well, you blah, 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 said this, and he's like, no, and he like rewinds his memory and like, this is actually exactly what I said. And then like, it's just kind of, you know, and you can share memories with people, and so, like, it gets pretty intense. So, haven't watched season 4 yet, but I'm expecting another standout season, and it is rated quite highly, with above a 9.0 on most sites, so.
Cassie?
Watched the movie Bright. It's on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, it's Will Smith and, oh, I forgot what the other guy's name.
An orc?
Well, yeah, he was an orc. I want to see his Joel something. Anyways, so different universe, creatures, like fairies and witches and all sorts of wands and stuff. So I like that movie. Watched... somewhat watched The Dark Tower. Got interrupted by bedtime, but I hope to finish that. So far it's pretty cool. It's different. I guess I didn't really know what it was about. I just started watching it. Chris turned it on, so I was like, ooh, this is nice. Saw that. What else did we watch? Oh, The Kingsman 2, we watched that like minutes away from, you know, New Year's 2018. Yeah. And so watched that.
That was pretty good, too.
So you brought up Bright, and that is one of the, obviously, you know, it's getting some, you know, people talking about it critically, and it's kind of level of quality, but it's getting some people, like, riled up, like, you know, it's completely wrong for them to, like, you know, enslave this orcish race, and they're presented like slaves and things like that. And, like, I was kind of, I kind of look at it like...
Any, yeah, to me, it's like, how's that different from any other movie? Like, I don't...
Yeah. And I thought that was the point of it, too, was to, like, yeah, this race, you know, this whole other race of beings and everything, yeah, they're kind of showing them they are, like, the slaves, the working class and stuff like that. And the elves are, like, all high-end, high-upper class. And I thought that was the point of the movie. And so I guess some people were just upset about that fact, though. So that was, I didn't think, it didn't make me mad. It didn't make me never want to watch that movie again, though, because it presented elves as high-end fashionistas and orcs as, like, more of a worker slave class. So.
I don't know. To me, it's like, how's it different from other movies? But how's it different from just books in general? Every time I've read like a fantasy story, orcs or whatever, are usually lower beings and fairies, and it doesn't matter in what world you're talking about. So I'm just like, okay, just watch the movie. That's it.
Yeah, and naturally I watched Bright as well. I was excited for it and just interested in having a whole other interaction or fantasy world that didn't have to do with Marvel or Tolkien. That's something brand new, and hopefully they can continue, similar to the Dark Tower that could be utilized. It's just its own world.
Mm-hmm.
As one of the big criticisms that have been coming out on the boards is they didn't do a very good job of explaining the background of the story. Like, why were the orcs this class? Why were the elves in this class? And what did the wand, how did it come into play? And how is it general knowledge for everybody, but generally not understood? So, as a result, Netflix has published a backstory that should have been in the film, but it's called The History of Magic, and they published it yesterday, and you can go online and watch it. It is about, it's about 2.5 minutes, and it just goes through that background so you can get a better understanding of the world they're trying to create. My only problem watching the show is I kept waiting for Martin to come out and Bad Boys 3 to start, and them killing off, like, orcs and elves and everything, and just, like, Mike Lowry and all of those characters. So that's probably what messed up for me. I kept expecting Bad Boys, and it wasn't supposed to be Bad Boys. It's just, if I see Buddy Cop, I see Will Smith, I think Bad Boys, and so that part hurt.
I guess, yeah. I guess I was just waiting for whatever they kept talking about, the quote unquote the Dark Lord, and I'm like thinking, oh, okay, so that's
Voldemort.
That's the guy. The guy's gonna come out at the end, I don't know, and they're gonna beat him. Yay, you know. But that didn't happen at all.
I kinda feel like this was a big setup and everything. You know, it actually, they said that it got like 110 million views in the first week. And so their $93 million price tag is looking pretty reasonable, all things considered. You know, that's what, a dollar per person, their subscription fee for that month, essentially. So, I don't know. I mean, I think the world is interesting enough to where I would watch a second or a continuation of the story. But I didn't realize they published that little anthology, so I'll have to go check that out. I understood what was going on, but I was also watching a lot of the graffiti on the walls and like some of the stuff that was like in the background and everything that I kinda liked how it wasn't spelled out and you had to piece together some of it. But I can understand the critique that, like, you're just kind of dropped in the middle of this world, and not really, the rules aren't explained, the reasons why and things like that either. But I'm interested enough to see a continuation of this story in this world, which I think what I'm gathering from most people who watched it, they're like, you know, okay, well, I mean, here, let's take two other actors and let pay them a lot less, you know, and we'll have the second orc on the police force or something like that and go from there.
I agree. I can see them continuing a different storyline. Maybe that focuses maybe on the fairies or whatever other creatures out there. I don't know.
You could do a whole elf-focused storyline, a whole human-focused, and a whole orc-focus.
But I liked being dropped into that world and not knowing what was going on. It was just kind of like, okay, obviously, they've come together and they're living together. Something happened. Cool. And you just kind of follow the two character or the main characters in the story that obviously they're trying to form this relationship that is unfortunately being forced, but they have to make it work together. But it just kind of comes with, like, being a police officer, you're going to get partnered up with somebody that you may not like. Duh. And you're just going to have to watch each other's back. So what's the really difference? I don't...
Riggs and Murtaugh. It's a classic tale.
And then, it kind of reminded me a little bit of... what's that one movie with Denzel Washington?
Training Day?
Yeah, Training Day. Like, it kind of had a spin off of that, too. It was just like, you know, you didn't really have my back. Let me show you the ropes, kind of, sort of. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, I've kind of taken a break from watching Hannibal. I still have about half the third season to finish. It is also the series finale. I started watching The Shield from episode 1. I just bought the whole season. Cassie bought it for me. So that's been a bit of my focus there. We did go and see Coco, the Disney movie about Dia de la Muerte, at the movie theater. It was really... It's a great movie. It's sad, but there's definitely redeeming features about it. So if you're in any culture that are close to the culture that celebrates Dia de la Muerte, I think it'll be a good watch. I don't recommend bringing a toddler to see it because it is a bit slow moving and it takes a while to get the characters. But if you have every child's going to have to interact with the loss of a grandparent or great uncle at some point. And this is a good way to broach the subject, I feel like. They have an understanding that their spirit still exists, but the person physically isn't there, but you can remember their deeds. I do have Peaky Blinders queued up in Netflix when I finish The Shield in a couple of weeks. I'll start the fourth season of that. We did finish Star Wars, which I enjoyed, and I don't get the criticism. So we're not watching much, we're just watching everything.
Oh, okay, I completely forgot. I did just watch the last two Chappelle comedy shows on Netflix.
Oh, we did too. We did watch that this morning, is Chappelle.
Brilliant. I completely agree with every one of his points.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kicked her in the pussy.
I
had to throw that out there.
I like the whole setup in the first one where he's like, or the third one, which is the second set. Mm-hmm. I'm just too good at this. It's just too easy for me. I have a bowl of just one-liners to end it, and I'm gonna pull out that I kicked her in the pussy, and I'll make the story come back around. Like, I do feel like the second set of stand-ups is better than the first set of stand-ups. That seems like the first, it was funny, he was getting some rust off. Mm-hmm. The second one, there was time for the audience and critics to critique the original set, and he was able to respond to all of that and still do him, which is interesting because he's not afraid of most of the critics as people would be. He's definitely not going to get any new fans off of this, but I think anybody who was a fan of Dave Chappelle will enjoy these more than the other two. And I really like the story about him getting stovetop stuffing.
Oh, yeah.
I have to go act like I called my mom.
Yeah.
It's, really no, good. That was fantastic. Christy?
No, I'm terrible. Or wonderful. I don't know. I think I'm going to start bringing something different to the show because I don't really watch a lot of TV. I didn't even watch Jimmy Fallon once this week. Like, I haven't watched anything since I last spoke with you guys.
All right, so what book have you been reading? I know you're an avid reader.
Everything is Marketing. But honestly, I mean, that's the name of the book, Everything is Marketing. I've been entertaining different ideas of opening my own business, and I don't know what I'm going to do yet. So I'm researching some things, so I'm doing a lot of researching in my spare time. But in the book that I'm reading, it's called Everything is Marketing. It was given to me and pretty insightful. It's geared towards a particular industry, but I think the title kind of says it all. Everything is marketing, like from your Christmas decorations, how you feel when you walk into a place, your supplies, everything. Anyway, so That's all. I will not bore you. I'm not quite as entertaining as you guys.
Oh, I was actually excited to hear more. Who's the author and how far are you through the book?
I'm not super far through the book yet. But the author is, I should know off the top of my head, I'm trying to look at my memory there, Fred Joyle. Yes, it was a gift to me, and even though it's pretty specific to the dental practice, don't worry, I'm not opening a dental practice, the insight is good as far as a marketing standpoint.
Okay, so I'll be interested in hearing a follow-up, and additional follow-up, how is that whiskey drinking for you?
Okay. So I took the first drink, and it was super strong, even though it was tasty, and you could taste a hint of sweetness on the back of it. It was burning my throat. So I added some water to it, and that made it much better. But I literally had two fingers or less, and I feel pretty good. Like, it's delicious, but here's what I wish. I don't want to drink it with water or neat or on the rocks. I need to go get some eggnog. I know I'm totally not being a bourbon snob. Bourbon's just not my thing. It's a little strong for me.
If you're over here, we have eggnog.
I love the flavor of it. I do actually genuinely like the flavor of it. It's just super strong.
Sounds like you just need more ice.
Yeah, my opinion of that, because I have to try it, and of course I've had the other.
You've had the wine.
This equation. Yeah, I've had the wine too.
I have not.
Interesting attempt. I am more excited to try attempt number two by both companies. If that makes
sure.
sense. I feel like this was almost too, like it was too new and too new to both sides of it and everything. The bourbon, being somebody who does drink bourbon, it's not my drink of choice, but I do drink it occasionally. I thought it was good, not smooth enough, and not near enough of some of the peaty flavors that I like in bourbon. But then again, of course, I love, you know, scotches and stuff, so, and everything. But the good bourbons that I like are those heavily oaked. And I feel like with old port barrels, you're not going to get that in everything. Is some of the that cedar, that oak, that kind of woodsy flavoring and everything. But I'm definitely more excited to try the second and third iterations of these products, if that makes any sense. But I'm also not going to pay, I think it's $100 a bottle, so I'm not going to pay that for it.
Oh, what, for the bourbon?
Yeah, it's really expensive.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Somebody gave this to me. Somebody gave it to me. I opened it today and I drank some.
I'm not trying to make you feel bad. I'm just trying to tell you that was a good present. It was a good present. I was sitting over here like, I don't like pizza.
I'm the wrong person to give a $100 bottle of bourbon to. That was delicious.
You might have gotten it on.
Okay.
I think if you're a member there, you get it for discounted. But I think for the public or something, it's like $100. Of course,
wow.
you know me, I don't pay anything for alcohol anyways, so.
I know.
Different things to people.
I do. I bought some full price wine from a winery just recently. I won't name any names, but anyway.
Yeah.
I was like, what just happened to my life? It was fine, and now I don't feel bad about it. Actually, I didn't feel bad anyway, because the people that I was buying, I didn't. I just bought it as a gift. People that I bought it as gifts for helped me out tremendously, and it was a small gesture. But yeah, no, here's what I liked about it. I liked the sweetness on it. I think the sweetness balanced, because I don't like the ones that you're talking about. But it's still too strong for me. Soup. It's a new Christy. Post brain surgery, she doesn't drink a lot of soup.
That's so sad. And that's something that we could fix. More soup. Less beer.
Well, I pretty much only drink wine now.
And we need to add soup to that. It's part of a balanced meal. Our balanced diet.
I probably need to add soup in small quantities like this, where it's nice, but not out. I don't want to drink soup out.
Okay.
I think on weekends,
my tolerance isn't there.
I think we should finish the show with everybody telling the audience what temperature it is outside with the wind chill. But days like this and weekends like this is definitely kind of more of a soup style of climate and everything. Like whatever soup you may like gin soup, you may like whiskey soup, you may like tequila soup, which is a probiotic, I'll add. You know, I think that this is definitely more of a, you know, sitting by the fireplace with your bowl of soup, I'm air quoting over here, definitely that kind of weekend. So
what is your soup? And what's the wind chill?
Well, I actually went ahead and, just because I was sitting by the fire and the Michelob Ultra wasn't cutting it, I opened up, this is just kind of my celebration of the new year, opened up my bottle of 25-year-aged rum that I picked up in Costa Rica last year, Centenario. So just some rum in my in my golden hour highball glass, and then with my ice balls that you guys got me for Christmas a couple of years back and stuff like that. So that's my soup of the day. And the temperature when I woke up this morning was -4 with the wind chill, but I think right now it's a more reasonable 10 degrees with the wind chill. So.
Ow. All right, well, in Houston,
well, we
right
now. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, in Houston right now, the temperature is approximately 35 degrees. It's supposed to drop to 25 degrees tonight. With wind chill, that will be 24 degrees because it's Houston. No, it was actually a little windy today, so it's probably going to end up feeling a lot closer to 10 degrees. So this is an official ice storm warning. We already survived the blizzard of 2017. Let's survive the freeze of 2018.
Okay.
Oh, and I'm sorry. On soup, I must add, I thought soup was only whiskey, so I'm going to continue with whiskey. not drinking any tonight, but that soup would be the Nikki Coffee Grain Whiskey, the Japanese style, or the Japanese bourbon style whiskey.
Nice.
All right, Christy or Cassie?
Well, I guess my soup is wine. I guess, I don't know. Or rum and coke. The end.
Okay, so soup is only whiskey, right? It has to be whiskey or bourbon.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, we made these rules. We used to go have soup at Bash's, and it was called Soup of the Day. And the soup of the day was whiskey. Yeah.
Well, okay, but you've got to also remember, inside a soup, there's bisques, there's, stews, there are cold soups. So I'm going to just use the general term soup to refer to anything that instead of drink, I eat with a spoon, except on the liquor side, I'm going to just say, yeah, if I take it with a little bit of ice in a small glass, it's going to be called soup.
No, it's gazpacho, but okay. I made a soup joke. Come on.
All right. So what is the temperature out in Georgetown?
It's 25. It feels like 19. The high today was 32. The high tomorrow is 34. So it kind of sucks. The first time, the last 2 years we didn't really have winter. Last year, I think we had 3 days below freezing. Now it's already snowed twice here and I have broken knuckles, so I'm probably looking at hibernating this winter. And drinking soup by myself and telling you about it. Not by myself, but you guys.
And the holiday season is over, so for all the people who aren't in the industry, this is the time when she finally gets to relax somewhat.
Yes.
And so, well, are there any additional notes before we sign off on this show? Cassie?
I don't have anything.
All right. And so I do have something, just so you know, as most people on the show have iPhones, and with the exception of one cool cat, Apple says it's sorry about secretly slowing down older models of iPhones to make sure there are no hard feelings. It will offer battery replacements at a reduced price from the normal price of $79. They'll do it for $29 on iPhone 6 and above, starting January 1st through 2018. And I have nothing new to add except Happy New Year. And
Happy New Year.
And drink more soup. Mike?
No matter what kind of soup.
Gazpacho for you. It's for me.
and so, anything to add, Mike?
Nope, that is it.
All right. Well, felt like that's a good show.
Yay!
All right. And I did get Mike his headphones. Did they work, Mike?
Well, okay. So I've got an iPhone 7, so I don't have a headphone jack.
Oh.
In mine. So I've got the adapter somewhere, but I think it's already packed up. So I just need to dig through some boxes and find it.
Okay, well, you'll be in Houston soon enough, and I can let you use my adapter. I don't think I've ever used it once. It's still in the box.
Yeah, I've got it on one set of my earphones, or like my old earphones, because I've got the old ones from my 5, and then I've got my new ones from my 7 and everything. The old ones I packed up, and I just kept the new ones out, so I just need to find them. They're somewhere in the house, so.
Okay. And Christy should be arriving shortly.
Okay, I'll look for it.
All right. Well, Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, and all of the things.
And all, yes, absolutely, to all of y'all. And if you want to yeah, if you want to feel it's now officially people born in 2000 cannot yet drink, but they're getting really close to it.
But they can fight in a war.
Yeah, so now a lot of them can
fight in a war, right?
Exactly. And so they should be able to drink and accept coupons from drink manufacturers to get home safely.
Yep.
Then we can change a bunch of laws. But, all right, y'all have a good evening, a great week. I'm taking tomorrow off happily, and I think Cassie goes back to work after a month off.
Whatever.
And
wow. Oh, yeah, so, like, okay, so I have to go to work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And then I go on a cruise the following week.
Nice. Very nice.
And then I didn't know, but that Monday I have off too, because it's like a bank holiday.
Made up holidays. This is what I'm telling y'all.
For 4 days.
If y'all ever want to feel like childhood again, just work in the banking industry. They take everything off.
That's awesome.
Just a note, it's -7 in Minneapolis, Cassie.
Oh, yeah.
-7.
Yeah.
Yeah, that means
I haven't seen many. Posts from Brian about how cold it is.
Oh, he did one this morning.
It's because it's too cold.
Okay. It was like
computers don't work at that temperature.
It was funny the way he said it. He's like, it's -12.
And so he'll be talking again once it's warmed up a little.
Yeah.
So it's just too cold right now to even think straight.
Hibernating.
Hey, all right, y'all have a good evening. I'll speak to you later. All right,
later, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
It's vodka in a bottle with fog already prepackaged inside. Lee Cowan explains.
Although you might think that a vodka still would be a great place to ring in the new year, it's actually just a giant tease. You can't drink any of it straight out of the tap because at this point in the process, it's 190 proof.
And just touch it to your tongue and you'll be able to get...
Yep.
It almost evaporates right
away.
Whoa,
it does.
That's why it's called a spirit.
Kaylee Shoemaker is the head distiller at Hangar One Vodka. It gets its name from its home, an old airport hangar at what used to be the Naval Air Station in Alameda, across the bay from San Francisco. You can make vodka out of just about anything that ferments, but here's something you might not know.
Your average bottle of vodka is actually about 60% water.
Is it really?
Yeah, it has a ton of influence on the final flavor.
Water, however, is a pretty coveted commodity in California, having just emerged from several years of drought. So, Shoemaker decided she'd experiment with a more sustainable option and try to squeeze water out of an icon. San Francisco's famous fog.
It turned out no one had tried it, which I was kind of surprised about.
No,
yeah, because
even with all this fog,
with all this fog, no one had tried it yet.
A quick meteorological lesson. Fog is essentially made up of tiny floating water droplets, and it turns out those drops do have a flavor.
It's water, so it's very nuanced.
So that's what fog tastes like.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like licking a wet rock, but in a good way.
It almost whispers to the places the fog traveled. And I mean, it sounds kind of silly, but with all that little bit of salinity and minerality, you can almost taste the journey of the fog, I would say.
Still, coaxing that water literally out of thin air does take a bit of engineering.
So in its most elemental form, this is a pea soup catcher.
Hangar One enlisted the help of Chris Follett, who has been wrangling clouds for years.
And since this one's up, how much has it collected?
It's collected more than 700 gallons since we installed it
He's a volunteer with a Canadian nonprofit called Fog Quest, which has been constructing special nets to catch fog in the mountains of Africa, Asia, and Latin America since early 2000. In one village in Guatemala, there are 35 of those nets set up. Together, they can capture up to 1,800 gallons of fog water a day.
It's a pretty simple process, right?
Yes.
I mean, if you think about it.
It's designed to trap the microscopic droplets in fog.
Yeah, you can see
it. And convert them into larger droplets, which then fall into the trough and are collected.
Here in the Bay Area, it can take up to a day to collect enough fog water to cut just a single bottle of vodka, which might be because there's less fog in general, says scientist Todd Dawson.
The length of time that the fog lingers around on the coast now has gone down by about 3 hours every single foggy day.
Dawson is an environmental scientist at UC Berkeley. He says over the last 60 plus years, there's been about a 35% decrease in the frequency of fog along the coast. And that, he says, may have a big impact on Northern California's other icon, the coastal redwoods, which depend on fog for both moisture and fertilization.
They also have less rainfall, along with less fog, means less water overall. And in the southern parts of the range, we're actually seeing that those coast redwoods are really suffering.
The lack of fog, in part, is why Hangar One's aptly named Fog Point Vodka is so pricey.
How much is it per bottle?
It retails at about $125 per bottle.
Fog isn't cheap.
No.
Much of the proceeds will go to fund FogQuest's nonprofit work, as well as to the California State Coastal Conservancy. Bottling San Francisco's fog won't keep it from thinning, but it does remind us that as we enter a new year, nature's resources are worth both toasting and saving.